Hello, everybody. Eric Bischoff here with you. A very special edition of 83 Weeks coming to you from, well, I'm in Cody, Wyoming. Evan Husney, where are you from, buddy? Where are you at?
I am in Brooklyn, New York, but originally, you know, I am from Minneapolis. And, you know, we went to Minnetonka High School, not together.
I went to high school with Evan Husney, and I went to elementary school with Eminem.
Yes, that's right.
Same school, so we have that in common.
There you go. Yep. And
Brian Gewirtz, my man.
Eric,
how are you?
Good to see you. I'm doing all right. I mean, I'm. They've discovered. Oh God, they discovered large holes in pipes under my kitchen sink. So I am in the quote unquote community room of my lavish New York City apartment and not in the actual unit itself, because they're currently making giant holes in the wall to fix these pipes. Creating my floor with water. It looks like the pitcher's mound at Citi Field. Because it's completely, yeah. I'm really screwed, basically.
Oh no!
Yeah.
Well, I did notice that you're wearing your Buffalo Bills hat, which really surprised me. And we went on to talk about the kind of just rabid support you have for New York sports teams, only to find out that that's not really true.
Yeah, like half.
And like there are certain people in this world, and they're very rare. Who are like, oh yeah, I like the Mets and Yankees, or I like the Jets and Giants, but like no one really like despises New York sports teams, like actual New York people, if it's not their team. So as a Mets fan, I don't want to see the Yankees doing well. I certainly don't care about the Nets. I only care about the Knicks, and I don't consider Jets and Giants to even be New York teams because they play in New Jersey.
Right.
Okay. Right where the New Jersey Devils play. And Devils don't have a problem admitting to where they play from. The Nets, who were in the same complex, you know, when they played in Jersey, also rightly called themselves New Jersey Nets. And I went to Syracuse where the Bills games were on every weekend. So
there you go. Yeah,
the natural fit.
Yeah.
And you've given a lot of thought to your angst.
Yeah.
It's not just a superficial response. This is deep.
Yes, it's well thought out.
Yeah. Okay, well, the reason we're here today, and I've got to tell you guys, from the first time I got a phone call about participating in the, I don't think it was titled yet, Who Killed WCW series, I'm not going to lie, I was ambivalent. And my thought was, you know, it's what else are we going to talk about? You know, if we're just going to do the same thing that's been done before, then, you know, always happy to help out, but can't get real excited about it. And I eventually became very excited about it. So let me ask you, Evan, or Brian, whoever best answers this. Where did the idea come from, and why did you decide to do it?
Well, I'll take it first, Brian. You chime in too. For many reasons. First and foremost, I grew up a huge WCW fan. I mean, like I mentioned, from Minneapolis. Nitro came through all the time, so I went to all the Nitro shows, so I have a huge affection for WCW. And then once, I think it was when we, on Dark Side of the Ring Season 4, we did the Bash at the Beach 2000 episode for the series, and we just noticed that there was so much online chatter coming out of that episode, like fans still so engaged, still enraged over, you know, what, you know, their personal opinions are, takes on that story or what happened at WCW. It just didn't seem like there was any sort of, or it just seemed like there was a lot of room to still discuss what happened at WCW. And we noticed just a tremendous amount of engagement and like reverence for that time period. So it was coincidentally when we were developing a podcast that could be like ancillary, you know, to what we were doing. Looking at like maybe we tackle an epic podcast series on, you know, the history, the rise and fall of WCW. And then it was talking with Brian, because, you know, $7 and I, you know, and me and my partner Jason, we had worked together on Tales from the Territories a few years back, and Vice wanted to kind of get the band back together, so to speak, of working all together with us and $7, and we sort of talked about what we could do, and this WCW idea was like on top of mind. And I was just sort of like, Brian, what do you think? Like, What if we were to tell the story of WCW, but mainly almost 100% from the perspective of the people who lived it from within? Because most of the documentaries that you see on this subject up until now have been told sort of by the WWE, or at least through that lens. And right. So this, what, you know, because, you know, history is written by the victors, so to speak. So this was an opportunity to tell a lot of what those documentaries missed, and to basically look at from within the company what had happened. And then the same thing, you know, I just, you know, I picked up Guy Evans' book, you know, Nitro, right, and loved it and read it cover to cover and thought, like, wow, this was, you know, very inspirational to what we could do. And we kind of jumped off from there. Was like, well, there's a lot in this book that has not been told in documentary television form before. So that's the genesis of it. But Brian, I'll let you take it from there if there's anything.
Yeah. I mean, what's funny is, first of all, the title, Evan came up with the title, Who Killed WCW? And he said it to me as a, like, yeah, we can call it that for now. And then we'll get something. We'll come up with something later. And then we just did, because it's a cool sounding title for, you know, a show like this. It's kind of tongue in cheek.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, to be taken literally, to not be taken literally, we'll explore all of it. But yes. Yeah, like Evan was saying, you know, we had a great time doing Tales from the Territories. Vice, you know, was looking for something a little bit more, I guess, you know, a little bit juicier, I guess, for lack of a better term. And, you know, 90s nostalgia being right now.
Yeah.
That also played in a big part of it, because people, it's kind of crazy to think of, because we all lived it and experienced it. It doesn't seem that long ago. But yeah, it is, all of a sudden you look back, oh my God, it's like 25 years ago.
Tell me about it.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah, and I know too, you know, from my perspective, I was mainly, you know, in transparency, a WWE fan growing up, you know, on Long Island and everything. But once the Monday Night War started, all the characters that I grew up with, you know, Hogan, Savage, Piper, you know, amongst others, had now all of a sudden been on, you know, are on Nitro and living the Monday Night Wars. And then, you know, being fortunate enough to actually being in the employ of WWE starting in November 99, and actually being in the Monday Night Wars from the inside. So I did think it was a great story to tell. And I also thought, you know, to Evan's point, you know, you haven't really had the unfiltered, and that's
right,
in fact, version of this story yet. Because even in the WWE docs and the Monday Night War series, which is great, it's imminently watchable, it's fun, you know, it tells both, you know, concurrently WWE story and WCW story, but the talent sitting down aren't told, like, yeah, of course you can curse. You could talk about this thing. You could talk about this business thing that, you know, normally wouldn't, you know, appear in a WWE program and that kind of thing. You certainly, you know, I know from watching it, that WCW and Turner executives specifically, you know, had never really been interviewed to tell their side of things and to tell their story. And, you know, all these factors, plus the fact that, you know, you're now approaching, you know, whatever it is, 2001. So, you know, like 23 years since the end of WCW, it seemed like if there was ever a time to play off of the 90s nostalgia, plus the inside, you know, are the relationships that we've cultivated and our relationship with Vice, especially Evan and Jason's, that now would be a great time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Brian, what about Rock? Was he on board right away to produce this, or did he have a take about WCW and Nitro that may be different than yours or Evan's?
He, sorry, I get very self-conscious looking at my Bills hat and making sure. It's Rock is, you know, at the end of the day, he's a big wrestling fan, you know, and he loved Tales from the Territories because he grew up, you know, in the territories, following his dad, Rocky Johnson, around from territory to territory, Memphis and Hawaii and, you know, in Connecticut, WWE and all over the place. And so, yeah, when I approached him and said, like, we have the opportunity to tell this WCW story, he was like, great, let's do it. Let's do it. And if we're going to do it, let's do it in the exact way that, you know, we're pitching it, which is unfiltered and like the no bullshit version of the story. He was on board for that, because at the end of the day, even though we have, you know, we're integrated into the WWE and part of the WWE family and what have you, but this isn't really a WWE story. You know, yes, they're like a part of it because their success, you know, in the post Mike Tyson shove and everything. And as, you know, as we explain in the doc, as you, Eric, specifically explain in the doc, you know, the Attitude Era slash the
Nitro Era,
but on WWE programming, you know, played a huge part in that. So he lived it too. And in fact, Rock wasn't even originally, you know, a talking head and a part of the on-camera, you know, experience for the show. He was like, no, I would love to sit down and give the perspective of the WWE during this time, even though, you know, that's just going to be a small part of it, because we don't have other pure WWE talents. We have obviously a lot of people in WCW also worked in WWE, but in terms of a pure, like, this is what we were thinking in WWE as the Monday Night Wars were happening, you know, that's a purely, you know, that perspective comes purely from Rock, and he actually volunteered and wanted to be the one to give it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, if I could add on to that real quick too, it was clear to us when we were doing the interviews, like when we first started filming the interviews, and a lot of the people who had been so hands-on like yourself with WCW, and obviously the way things wound up at the end of the day with the company, I think it was challenging for most to speak like enthusiastically about, you know, the heyday of WCW. We weren't getting like, you know, the enthusiasm about when things were great, you know? And so there was sort of a need for a voice to kind of put it all over, you know, when things were great, you know, this is like, let's make the audience also feel how great these things were. And it was kind of serendipitous that, you know, when Dwayne had reached out and said that he wanted to sit down for an interview, it was like, perfect. He's the perfect person to do it, because he had, you know, a lot of, he had a lot of reverence for it. And especially like during when things were getting heated during the Monday Night Wars, you know, he cites in the doc itself that it was like a source of inspiration, like watching what, you know, you guys were doing on Nitro, which, you know, in 1996 was so cutting edge. And it's like, well, we got to step our game up and do, like, why can't we do things like that? So it was cool to like hear it, you know, and he's like the perfect person for it. So it was great. It worked perfectly. And I just want to quickly mention it before I get in trouble. It actually wasn't me who came up with the title, Who Killed WCW? It was Sean Robb, one of our producers, who had worked on the show from the very beginning, and it was a fun idea to sort of frame it as a murder mystery in a way, but it is very tongue in cheek because there's a lot of different characters that emerge throughout this series, and it's not necessarily a one to one, like, you know, single answer, obviously. But, and that's something that, of course, we explore throughout the whole series, but it was kind of a more fun, irreverent, you know, way to, frame it all, you know, rather than being, you know, super serious about it.
Was there anybody that you wanted to interview that you didn't get a chance to interview, or that just wouldn't interview?
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. There definitely was, you know, we definitely had sort of a set number of shooting days, you know, kind of a boring answer for our budget and what we could accomplish with the show. So, you know, if things would have been different in that department, there was a lot of other people I would have loved to have interviewed, for this. But there, you know, I one person that comes to mind that sort of, you know, might be a prime suspect for Who Killed WCW is Jamie Kellner, the person who, you know, literally and figuratively pulled the plug at the end of the day. He was, you know, he took over at Turner Broadcasting near the end of WCW's run, and we reached out to him in hopes of really getting him on board, because he did go on the record with Guy Evans' book the first time he ever, I think, really spoke publicly about WCW, and unfortunately, he turned us down. And I think that he couldn't really understand still at the end of the day why 25 years later people still want to talk about this.
He's such a dipshit. What do you think he did when he did in the first place? I didn't know that wrestling stuff could work.
Yeah, well, I didn't say it. But yeah, I mean,
damn, that, you're a dipshit.
Well, it... but it would have been good, you know, just sure. for the completeness, you know, for just to complete the whole thing, it would have been great.
Outstanding. Did you, well, again, now I don't want to give anything away. And actually, you know, we talked a little bit before we went on and hit record. I haven't seen the first episode yet. And like, I have dueling brain lobes at battle inside my skull, because somewhere in my mind, I want to see this thing so bad before anybody else does. But the other part of my brain says, no, wait. Mm-hmm. React to it when you see it. Don't have any preconceived ideas about how the audience is going to react. I just want to watch it like everybody else. But I am a little nervous. But without giving anything away, did you learn anything? Did you learn anything that really surprised you in your interviews?
I mean, yes. I mean, I'm not like going into this. I wasn't a scholar, you know, if you will, with everything that went down beat by beat, all the minutiae towards the end, especially what was happening behind the scenes. You know,
I mean, you weren't reading Dave Meltzer's dirt sheet?
No, not as much. But I think something that the show does very well is sort of illustrate how, you know, decisions made by individuals, just regular old individuals, you know, and how that shaped the future of this entire organization, you know, right in terms of the end as well too. And I think that sort of, to me, is just like, I don't know, bringing the human side of the story, if you will, to it is something that, I don't know, for me felt very fresh and very new in terms of this whole saga. And so that to me, there's a lot of things where we peel back the layers in terms of just how things were put together, like how creative ideas were executed. Like, just, you know, how many times as wrestling fans have we heard the story of Hulk Hogan's heel turn? I've heard it a million times, but I had never heard the detail about Kevin Sullivan, like pretty much, you know, sequestering Hulk, you know.
He did everything but tie him to a kitchen table.
Exactly. Like that was cool. You know, when you get into just the creative choices, when we interviewed Neil Pruitt, it was super cool just to hear him break down the infamous lawn dart moment and sort of talking about like his artistic, you know, inspirations in terms of how to film it and citing things like Hill Street Blues, you know, as like an inspiration of how they would do these long meandering takes moving through scenes with one shot. And it's like, man, that's so cool. I wish people had those types of, you know, influences nowadays in wrestling and stuff. So just like a lot of little details in terms of like how things were put together, like in the, you know, in the heyday of WCW was really, really illuminating. And like I said, just kind of bringing a human quality to the whole story felt very new to me, you know, at this.
Yeah. Brian, did you get any, I'm just going to go ahead and say it, WWE typically in the past has had a reputation of not playing well with others, meaning if it's not their project that they don't have control, they hadn't been too excited about participation. Did you get cooperation from WWE? Did you need any cooperation in terms of footage and things like that? And how tough was it to get if you did?
Well, that's a great question. I do want to go back real quick, just in terms of what Evan was saying, because I learned new things as well. And, you know, for me, it was you could read an interview with, say, a Bill Goldberg and a Bret Hart, and there's obviously heat with each other and everything else. But to actually see them, you know, and to see the footage that they're talking about and the match that they're talking about and hear Bret say, yeah, and then he whispered in my ear, watch out for the kick. And I'm like, what? And then it's edited where you could actually see Goldberg whispering that to Bret and see their honest reactions. And they're POV, because they're both right, they're both wrong. You know, like, however you want to, depending on your point of view, you know, Goldberg flat out, you know, Bret says Goldberg didn't know what he was doing. And Goldberg says, yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. I was rushed in and put in there. It's like
surprise,
such a
surprise.
Honesty, you know, from pretty much all the talent. Even talking about, like, you, Eric, giving the book to Kevin Nash at the time. And hearing from Kevin and hearing from you the whys and the specific reasons and how you were getting burnt out and everything else. And Kevin, you know, his philosophy about the chase and how much money is in the chase as opposed to the champion, you know, having it and defending it. It's all fascinating. And truly, like, even if you've heard versions of it before, like, this way felt new and fresh still.
Yeah. And man, I don't want to give anything away or more away, But I will say, no, it's fine. One other thing too for me was like, Eric, just when you were telling the story about, I'm sure you've discussed it on the podcast before, but when you told the story about like being under investigation, you know, by some of your peers at Turner Broadcasting, and all the things that went into just, you know, your disillusionment within the company and everything you were up against too, you know, in terms of, I think that's a very underappreciated part of the story of just all the different corporate factors that you're up against, just even dating back to 1998, you know? And so I think that comes to life and will feel pretty new. And that was very new to me just in terms of, you know, all the things that was going on there in those last few months when you were there, you know, as the president of the company.
Yeah, it was a real fun time. It'll be interesting to see it because a lot of it, believe it or not, I've just kind of put it out of my mind. I tend to only remember good stuff.
And yeah.
I don't carry the bad shit around with me because it gets to be too much. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it'll be interesting to go back. But Brian, I want to go back to the WWE support question.
Sure.
How did you get access? Were you able to get a hold of stuff that you might, that Evan might not have otherwise been able to get a hold of, were it not for the $7 connection?
We didn't, you know, not in terms of like footage or anything like that, because I guess we didn't really need it. And as Evan will get into, you know, there's all this uncovered found footage from the last Nitro taping that's really cool. But, you know, our thing is always like, we have, you know, familial and now, you know, legal ties to WWE with Rock.
Yeah, you know this guy on the board. I guess that helps.
Yeah. But obviously this show was in development and shooting before even that happened.
That's right.
But, you know, the relationship is such that, you know, Rock can call Nick Khan, president of WWE, and say, hey, I just want you to know we're doing this show with Vice. We had done a show with Vice in the past, and we had worked with WWE on Tales from the Territories to secure Jerry Lawler and Michael Hayes for a panel at the time, because they were, you know, WWE employees and/or legends. And, you know, we needed, you know, to get that clearance. And we did, because we know, you know, and they know, you know, our mindset of like, look, this is us producing it. We're going to take care of the business. We're not going to be telling these stories that make the business look like, oh my God, we want to tell entertaining, crazy, like, oh my God, what a crazy era. And can you believe this stuff happened? And it's told from the person, the people that, you know, it happened to, and the brilliant recreations, you know, that Evan and Jason do. But this is the same deal. It's like, you know, I think Dwayne did have a conversation with Nick just to let him know, like, hey, this is what we're planning on doing. This is the story we're going to be telling. It is not really WWE centric. Obviously, we're going to be telling the story of how WWE was a part of all of it. But we know what we're doing in terms of, like, you know, making sure the business is taken care of, making sure that there's not going to be anything that, like, will be, you know, get WWE on the phone. They need to answer to this, because it's not, you know, that's not the story. The story of WCW is pretty much a Turner WCW story in general. And so, yeah, that trust basically gave the, you know, WWE essentially being like, great, we know what you guys are all about. We know the love you have for the business. Let us know if you need anything. Let us know if there's, you know, anyone you want us to try to reach out to, or that kind of thing. And really, though, you know, there wasn't, because we reached out to the majority of the talents, because most of the talents are not really WWE centric anymore, even if they have legend contracts with them. So, yeah, it was very, very smooth. And, you know, they were like, great. And we didn't have to get like approval or anything like that. There are certain things in the show that we'll get into later, I'm sure, on this podcast, where we're like, oh, you know what, let me buzz WWE on this just to make sure they're aware of it, and that, you know, they're cool with us even covering this, which they were.
Can you give us one example without giving it, or I don't want you to give too much away, because I really don't, but you teased me a little bit there.
Okay. Well, you know, there's a conspiracy theory out there about, you know, how WWE had acquired WCW at a certain price. And that's something that, you know, the last episode of this is a four-part series, Who Killed WCW? And it is a big part of the fourth episode, which we get into, who the two sort of main figures who who would have facilitated such a, you know, conspiracy theory were directly interviewed about it. So it's a very interesting part of
can't wait to see that.
Yeah, this whole saga that definitely you're not getting in the other documentaries on the subject. So
much fun.
Yeah.
Hey, and I know you guys asked me to reach out to my former assistant and close family friend, Janie Engel. Now, I don't want to know what Janie had to say. I'm not asking you that. And I don't know if you were on site when she was interviewed, but Janie has been, she's like a unicorn. Like everybody I know that's ever produced a frame of anything to do with WCW has called me and said, hey, can you get Janie to help us out? We'd really like to interview Janie. And the answer has been for 20 years, nope, not doing it. Not doing it. And I always felt like she was like, if I was producing something, she would be the one, because she knows where all the bodies are buried. The bodies they buried before I ever came to WCW and every one of them that have been buried after that. She did it. Like, I don't think she's done another interview. Do you know how nervous or initially reluctant she might have been?
Yeah, it was. From what I recall, it was a process to sort of get her on to get her on board for the show, and I believe that, you know, she is friends with Medusa to this day, and Medusa is also in the show as well too. She was a great, you know, she's great in the show, and she helped us, I think, to also kind of, you know, tip Janie over the edge with you know, being a part of the project. But she's fantastic. She's fantastic, and she had just a wealth of like cool old photographs from back in the day, you know, with her, with all the main talent and everything. And you're right. She was there for like everything and she remembers everything. And she was a huge, just great resource for the show. And she's great in the show. So really cool to be able to interview her. That when you ask about, you know, some of my favorite interviews, that definitely for sure was up there. Absolutely.
Yeah, and again, I don't think, you know, we've all seen a lot of different, you know, documentaries and PR pieces about WCW.
Yeah.
Janie is such a sweet and honest human being. I'm anxious to see her and hear what she has to say, because, you know, she remembers things that I don't remember for sure.
Yeah, what she's great.
But when this podcast is, you know, Conrad takes me through all these different eras of the Monday Night Wars, and we go back and I watch a show and I know I was there because I can see myself on camera, but like I don't remember it. You know, they all run together to me. So it's always fun to listen to, especially an interview that you haven't heard before.
Totally. 100%. And Brian was talking about earlier about some footage. This actually might be the thing that's some of the most exciting, which is I think it was Neil Pruitt got us in touch with he worked for WCW towards the end as a cameraman or something. His name was Scott Lansing. And he had been sitting on, now for 23 years, never before seen, never before released, 3 days worth of footage that he had filmed, like documentary footage he had filmed, you know, like in Panama City, in the days leading up to the final episode of Nitro. And when we heard about this, we're like, what? We need to get this immediately. And so we were able to work out a deal, and I got all the footage, you know, here, and I went through every frame of it myself, and it was amazing. It's just such an amazing time capsule of, like, you know, backstage access, you know, like interviews with the talent. You can definitely tell there's like a sense of tension and unease and uncertainty about the future and what's going to happen with the company. And it's just so cool to see all of this too. Like,
yeah, I saw a little bit of that on a clip you guys, Dark Side, posted the other day.
Yeah.
I mean, there are literally guys backstage hugging each other like, okay, this is the end of the road, man. We're going to end up going our separate ways. And I mean, even though it was just a clip and you're only seeing a couple of seconds of this footage, it was powerful because we know what was going on. And that's going to be just seeing the reaction online, that's going to get a ton of interest.
Yeah. And it was like when I was going through it and I saw, like, whoa, that's Shane McMahon in the ring, like in the afternoon, you know, like standing in the middle of the ring. There's Bruce and like there's Gerald Briscoe, and like it was crazy, just surreal to see that. And there's also like other really touching things where, you know, the Scott, the guy who filmed the footage, was smart enough, I think, and keen enough to, you know, do interviews with like a lot of the stage hands, you know, a lot of the guys who worked, you know, doing production design or were grips or just people that had been with the company for so long. And so you hear from these guys, they're just like,
oh, yeah, man, that's gold.
That's gold. It's just all gold. And like just really just emotional shots. Like you see like a little board like that's in the back. Like there's like the sign that says like, here, you know, write your phone number on this board so we can all keep in touch with each other and stuff. And it was just like, whoa, that just, you know, that definitely, you know, pulls at the heartstrings. It's pretty cool stuff. So I'm glad that we were able to work that into this as well too.
And if you're listening, just a reminder that the Who Killed WCW premiere episode Tuesday night, 10 o'clock Eastern, you're going to want to check that out. And then immediately following, I'll be going live. Get my reaction to the very first episode. I'm excited. I'm scared. I'm all that shit. Can't wait to do it.
Can't wait to right do on. It.
You know, for me, by the way, like in terms of my favorite, I really loved hearing from Brad Siegel. The head, because he just hasn't done these interviews in a wrestling, you know, show documentary before. Not at least, not to my knowledge. And he was the head guy, basically, at Turner, the one that everyone, you know, reported to. And just to give his perspective, because he's a self-admitted not wrestling guy and not like a, you know, he's a television programmer. And to give that Turner perspective, to be able to also hear from Ted Turner's son, who we have in there, and all these other, you know, either WCW employees or Turner employees that you've just never heard from. That to me was really fascinating to get inside his POV. And then I just love for the, you know, because we're now like 20 plus years past the final episode of Nitro. So almost, I mean, I think really across the board, every talent that's interviewed just has this aura of, I don't give a shit. I'm just going to say whatever I feel.
Yeah.
They do it. And so it's like, that is just so refreshing to see like Kevin Nash saying what he's going to say. And he does, he clearly has a, I don't give a fuck. This is what I'm
going to
say attitude, you know, Booker and Charmel, like everybody across the board, you know, just truly, you know, obviously you included Eric, but truly speak from the heart.
Yeah.
And this isn't like a, they're not sitting down going, okay, so what's Twitter or Reddit going to think if I say this, or how is it going to be in the dirt? They're just saying, you're asking me a question. This is my answer. And this is how I honestly feel. And
Ron, I think Brian, there may be, well, I'll just speak for myself. Previously, you know, I think WWE did a look back at WCW and Monday Night Wars, and I was a part of it. I was interviewed when I was working for WWE. And even though I'm talking about my company in that period of time, WWE signing my check. And whether it was conscious, I'm sure it was at some point, or subconscious, which I'm sure it was 100% of the time, I'm responding to questions knowing who signs my check. And it's just, it's human nature, you know? And if I'm doing it, you know, I know for a fact, and so many of the interviews I've seen in the past are from talent who are partially doing what I did when I worked for WWE, remembering who signs their check. And part of it is just their own agenda. And it'll be interesting now that time has passed and so much of that doesn't matter anymore. It'll be really interesting to hear those perspectives.
For sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, pretty much all those interviews, you can tell that it's not a, I better make sure the auspices of WWE approve of what I'm saying. Because, you know, that doesn't come into play. It's not a factor. And I think that's really, you know, the entire four-part series, you know, is, you know, that POV of, I'm just going to say what I'm going to say. Consequences be damned. This is how I truly feel permeates everything and from everybody. And it's just refreshing. Even like there's some stuff that I've heard before. There's some stuff that I've never heard before. There's some stuff in between, like I've heard, but not from this specific, you know, POV. And then that everything like that you see on the show, I found, is just put forth in a consequences be damned. This is what I'm saying. and this is how I feel truly in my heart, and I don't give a shit if anybody.
It's very genuine. Yeah.
So Brian and Evan, how does this, it's a 4-part series, which number one, I'm surprised you were able to get 4 episodes out of it. That suggests to me that you've got a lot of really good material. But does it follow an arc? I mean, are we going to fall in love with WCW in the first act and begin to experience, you know, the tension and then cry at the end? How should I prepare for this?
It does get a little emotional at the end.
It does, yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Because this isn't just a, you know, starting, you know, in frame one, episode one, here it is, finger poke of doom, followed by Judy Bagwell on a forklift. You know, you gotta really see
all the hits
of how the company came about, from the studio show on TBS, you know, to WCW Saturday Night, to the Mall of America, and all of a sudden, you know, filling arenas at unprecedented levels. And you really, you know, the show takes its time as far as painting that picture.
Yeah.
Where it came from,
yeah,
how it came to be, and the huge success by diverting from what was, you know, done in wrestling at the time. Because you got to raise those stakes and make people care before, you know, you see the implosion.
Yeah.
And let me write that down. Raise the stakes. And what was that? Make people care.
Yeah.
This from a guy that knows how to write a story. Yeah. By the way, thank you so much for that gimmick minister thing I did.
Oh, awesome.
I give you credit for that every single time. I wasn't even really sure if you were the instrument behind that, because you never knew in WWE whose idea was what.
I was definitely the writer of that segment, and I'm not even sure, you know, it's where the idea originally originated from, but it was one of the most favorite segments. The, you know, Eric Bischoff disguised, for those who don't know, Eric Bischoff disguised as an old man moderating or officiating, you know, the wedding or the whatever it was, commitment ceremony, whatever
it was. Yeah, Billy and Chuck. It was a commitment ceremony.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And then tearing off the makeup.
Yeah.
And then, you know, of course, at the time, without getting too off track, because we can't, you know, we just can't, as you know, Eric, we just can't let it sit. That was a great classic time capsule moment. Let's just let it live and move on. We got to try it again with Rikishi. Like,
right.
Right. Backstage is like, everyone backstage with Eric is like, who is that odd eccentric man who just asked for a drink of scotch or whatever it was? Really weird. And then everyone backstage during the Rikishi was like, why is Rikishi in a dress?
Like, yeah,
well, no, that's disguise. Don't you see he's going to rip off his thing? And like, oh.
But Brian, I've never had it. You know, because you and I have never talked about this. I didn't find out that you were behind that scene until many, many years after I was gone. I haven't really had a chance to talk to you about that. But I had so much fun doing that. You know, I spent an entire afternoon walking around backstage trying to become that character. And amazing. I was like messing with people. I was walking up to Brad Riggins, who's a friend of mine, made the Olympic team in 1980, I believe it was. And he was the shooter before Kurt Angle showed up. He's back there with his 2 stepdaughters who were around 12 or 13. And I walked up to him and just all kind of hunched over and shaking my head. You smell good, little girl. I have candy in my room. And I'm thinking, Brad's just going to rip me to shreds, but he didn't know what to do because I look so old and frail. You can get away with anything.
Oh, so brilliant. You know, our friend Kasama, the stage manager, you know, she, you know, longtime WWE employee, seen it all, knows where the bodies are buried. And she came up to me and was like, yeah, the guy you have as the priest keeps, you know, asking for alcohol and he needs to do something.
That's awesome.
Yeah, like, I'm like, it'll be okay. He knows what he's doing.
The most fun I've ever had.
We should say that clip does make an appearance in the episode 4.
Oh, I'm so glad. It's the best work I've ever done.
It's in there. It's in there. Yeah, for sure.
Guys, I can't wait for this premiere episode. I'm still as excited. I'm actually more excited and slightly less nervous about it. So
good.
Thank you for taking the time. And Brian, I'd be remiss to let you go if I didn't ask you, what's the deal between Cody and Conrad? Man.
I
Conrad got hit with you or what?
I think Conrad has a deep love of Cody. This is what's so funny, Eric, as you know, like we're talking about the WCW series.
Oh no!
For a good hour. And now I'm going to say something about Conrad and Cody and then all of a sudden become Captain Clickbait. And
there you go.
It's going to be the headline.
Yep.
You know, Conrad and Cody have a, you know, I don't know. I'll have a fun conversation with Conrad about his tweets when the initial shift from, you know, Cody and Roman to Rock and Roman back to Cody and Roman, you know, happened, because he seemed to get irrationally, for a grown man, you know, upset about many of the things that were happening on his television screen. But the conversation, I guess, what we'll have, you know, either publicly or privately, either one is fine with me, another day.
All right. We'll save it. Maybe it'll be an 83 weeks exclusive.
Yeah, there you go. Charge something for it.
Hear. Well, guys, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Brian. I know how busy you are, and Evan, you as well. You're just killing it. I can tell you're still not a Hollywood guy, because you actually gave credit to the guy who named the show and didn't take it for yourself, because you could have very easily. So clearly you haven't been in Hollywood.
Not yet. Yep.
Well, Eric, thank you, by the way. And thank you for sitting down for the show and for letting, you know, the crew into your home and everything else. It was,
yes,
it really is a fascinating journey and a fascinating story. And we're really lucky that, you know, you gave your time to be a part of it.
Well, I would say always a pleasure to work with you guys. And any chance I get to work with you, Brian, you know, I'll take it. So I'll look forward to it. Maybe we'll do a follow-up at the end of the four episodes and reconvene and see how we all fared.
Okay, let's do it.
All right, again, all right. That's Tuesday night coming up, 10 o'clock Eastern on Vice TV. Don't forget to check it out and check out me live on YouTube right here, 83weeks.com. And you'll get my reaction. Take your comments. We'll make you famous. Thanks, guys.
See you, man. Take care.